I'm Spencer.
And I'm Andrew, and you're listening to the At a Distance podcast from The Slowdown. Today we'll be speaking with Tristan Harris, co-founder of the Center for Humane Technology and co-host of the Your Undivided Attention podcast.
Previously, Tristan created the nonprofit initiative Time Well Spent, and before that, he spent 3 years as a design ethicist at Google. The Atlantic magazine has described him as the closest thing Silicon Valley has to a conscience.
He is working rigorously to help shape a world in which technology supports our shared well-being. He has an uncanny ability to make sense of the world we're living in and present the tools and solutions to tackle complex global challenges. We're thrilled to have him on the podcast today. Let's get him on the line. Hi, Tristan. Welcome to At a Distance. It's great to have you with us today.
Great to be here, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
So what I want to start with was, what's at the top of your mind right now?
I mean, honestly, the top of my mind is just thinking about how the world is unfolding. I mean, many of us have been looking at existential risk and the ways that the economic logic that our overall systems run on create unsustainability across the playing field. Obviously, this is true as much as true of technology as it is of the ecological system and climate. But when I think about especially the kind of breakdown of truth in the coronavirus era as influenced by the technology platforms, I think, you know, we've been making this critique for a long time that in an attention economy, so long as you're sorting by just what gets attention, it introduces all of these distortions and unregulatable misinformation whack-a-mole games that you cannot solve. And we've been making that critique for probably 6-7 years now. And I think now the consequences are life and death and very apparent to people, and no one knows what's going on. So I just think it's just simply dialing up to the extreme level everything that I think many people you and I know in common have been concerned about for a long time. And so I think that's the real question is, how do you reboot from a system of so little trust and so much confusion and just so much insanity, frankly? Mm-hmm. And obviously the increasing role of technology platforms being visible in this, as I think that for many reasons, one, that we're now relegated to our screens for many more hours a day than we ever have been. So any ways in which technology has not been humanely designed or thought of, you know, they were visible before, but now it's extremely visible. It's sort of like if you use the metaphor of ergonomics, if you sat in an unergonomic chair, a chair that was not totally humane for 30 minutes a day, you know, it's a problem, but you don't really notice it. But when suddenly you have to spend 10 hours a day in that chair, you really notice what's different about a flat video conference communication on Zoom versus the kind of touch and contact and, you know, trust and et cetera that are really necessary. So at all levels, I think everything is just dialed up to the extreme. And that's what this moment is revealing. And how we get out of that is something that's really hard to think about. Because I take on responsibility for how we, especially with our organization, the Center for Humane Technology, how do we actually act in this moment to try to steer it? And there's a lot of discontinuous opportunity now that we haven't had before as well.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about the word pandemic, like the etymology of the word, you've been studying the pandemic of technology for a long time. And trying to bring things to light to help us in kind of extraordinary ways. So what I want to move to is, can you help us in a way make sense of what we're experiencing right now sort of broadly? So not just within the virus, but what we've been experiencing for the sort of uninitiated or the people that may not have interacted with your content yet and your talks. What are we going through? And then I'd love you to sort of move into kind of how that's playing out within this moment of just the last couple of months.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess taking it from the top a little bit, for those who don't know my personal background, I used to be a design ethicist at Google, and I was studying the attention economy and the kind of fallacies and biases and vulnerabilities of the human mind. That was an extension of much earlier work, starting when I was about 6 years old as a magician, looking at the fallacies of the human mind, then going up through persuasive psychology, studying with a professor named BJ Fogg at Stanford University, who had the Stanford Persuasive Technology Lab, and then going into behavioral economics and cults and transformative persuasion and transformative experience. And these are all things that are essentially about how the human mind is this choke point upon which all decision making happens. So if you could hack en masse, you know, this choke point of this agent's instrument, like the cockpit of all decision making, which is the human mind, that gives you access to shape history, because you just change that a little bit and you can change the outcome of anything. And, you know, I was studying that at Google starting in 2013 after a presentation went viral in the company that I created that said, you know, never before in history have 50 designers at five technology companies essentially held the collective consciousness, the collective subconscious and psyche, you know, the Jungian psyche in our hands. And that specifically the game theory, the competition for this finite pool of attention, this finite limited resource, that suddenly we inflated the attention economy when we gave each of us our own platform, each of us our 20,000 followers, our 30,000 followers. So now we already had finite attention back in the days of CBS and the five TV channels or whatever. But suddenly when you try to fit 7 billion people into their own media broadcasting station, and all of our, it's like we've just blown out the attention economy. And much like the Earth's carrying capacity being limited, and I think the US is like something like each of us live, if everyone lived like the US, we would need 40 Earths, I think, to sustain ourselves. And it's like much like in the sort of social media version, where that's like kind of the bloated attention economy, where each of us are living in an attention environment that would suck out way more attention than we have. And kind of what are the costs of that? So the first, you know, we talk about addiction, the fact that in the race to the bottom of the brainstem for attention, you do better the lower in the brainstem you go. So the more I hack into social approval, validation, give you that instant feedback, that feels better than an app that does not give you instant feedback. And so everyone kind of plays in this increasingly aggressive race for attention. The first effect is addiction. But then you go into social validation, how that affects mental health of teenagers and how that affects the speed of life, because I think your podcast is all about how we can be humane to ourselves and obviously slowing down. And then that goes into polarization, because this choke point of the human mind is the sense-making instrument that we are all trapped inside of, for better or for worse. And if you can't see distortions that you're living inside of, that's kind of it. I mean, I'll give you a small example. You know, when you really study cognitive science, the premise is that our mind is already shaped kind of in a way that has us make meaning in certain directions versus others. It's like we're not like neutrally making sense of the world. So I'll give you an example. If I drew two objects in front of you, one was this sort of sharp, pointy object, like imagine one of these like sharp, pointy, I don't know, metal toys or something, versus this soft, cloud-like object. So these two objects. And I said, which one of these objects is named Kiki, and which one is named Booba? And it's obvious that your mind, no matter which language you speak, no matter what culture you're a part of, the almost geometry of the way that your mind organizes soft sounds versus harsh, crisp sounds, pointy sounds, that Kiki is the sharp object and Booba is the soft object. Mm-hmm. Another example is if I give you two theoretical pain medications, Pavel and Bavel. I'm a marketer, I've got this new pain medication, we're gonna try to figure out what I call this thing. And I said, which one of these names, Pavel or Bavel, works faster? Does Pavel work faster or does Bavel work faster? And 90% of people say that Pavel works faster, and that's because P is an unvoiced consonant. So it's like, think of your mind like a kaleidoscope that's pre-bending the meaning of information as it comes in. Mm. And you didn't choose that Pavel was supposed to be faster. Mm-hmm. You're living inside of an automatic process. You're a robot that is perceiving in a controllable way. For someone who knows that your mind perceives that way versus if you don't know, and anytime there's that asymmetry of perception, I win and I control your experience. Mm-hmm. And in the case of technology, it's now this race for mass influence, for whoever knows more about how your mind works is how you win. And that's happening both in our electoral politics and the way that certain people use Twitter. And it's true also of the way that technology is designed itself to kind of tap into these invisible features of how our minds work.
Mm. First time I heard of you and what kind of brought you to public attention was in 2013 when your slide deck went sort of viral. Mm. And I was thinking about that last night before talking to you. I thought, if you were to make a slide deck now that went viral about this moment, what would it have in it?
That is a really good question. And the slide deck to going viral inside of Google or going viral inside of the whole world?
Because the whole world.
The whole world, yeah. Well, we're working on that in a different way with a documentary film. But yeah, you know, I think, gosh, the thing I really want people to know, the thing I would make viral right now, obviously our work is trying to be about how do you change the way that we make technology so that we change how we're impacting society so we're not driving ourselves totally mad and crazy. And I think there's a fallacy in thinking that the only thing to do is to fix the Facebook news feed or fix, you know, the way that home screens or notifications work. What we really have to do is I don't think we properly understand the kind of hypnotic spell that we've been inside of for the last 15 years. And there's something in psychology called the subject-object move. It's part of human development. Like if you are anxious, if you're feeling anxious, but anxiousness is kind of the tinted colored glasses that you're wearing and it shapes your experience and you don't know that you're anxious, then it just starts controlling you. You make worse decisions because you're operating more impulsively. And the subject-object move is being able to name and see, oh my God, there's anxiety there. And the part of you that can name the anxiety is not in the anxiety, it's above the anxiety. So the subject-object move is about taking what you're subjectively merged or blended into the fabric of, and then putting it down as an object that you can stare at. And the part of you can stare at it is not the anxious thing. So I think we're living in a 3 billion people have gone mad because of technology scrambling our attentional and informational environment. And if we don't properly get 3 billion people, this is why you asked me if the presentation went viral. If I could reach 3 billion people right now, I would want 3 billion people to be able to see the process of maddening. We call it like human downgrading. There's a lot of different ways of phrasing it. But the point being that our attention, our mental health, especially our information environment, the basis for what we know to be true or agree with or biased, et cetera, that's been scrambled. And if we don't properly account for that and take that in, I don't think there's a way we can proceed. So I think of it more like the first step is this kind of truth and reconciliation committee of like, this is this thing that happened to us. There's the largest hypnosis experiment that's ever been run that ran for 15 years that we went through. You know, we put society through this sort of washing machine and it rolled around the kind of polarization, outrage machine, extremism, et cetera. And if we don't recognize that that happened, then what we're experiencing now is natural and true. And we have to get to, it's not natural, it's not true. There's a part of us that needs to climb up to a perch and see this thing that's happened to us. So that's kind of what I really most want. Has to see.
We need Archbishop Tutu to get everyone in the valley on a committee and do truth and reconciliation.
Yeah.
It's a great idea. Yesterday, Twitter finally fact-checked Donald Trump, but actually refused to take down his tweet accusing Joe Scarborough of murder, despite it being a totally baseless claim, obviously. Do you think Twitter is going to police his commentary moving forward to the election? Is this a one-time thing? Do you feel a shift? Was that profound to you or not?
So yesterday was a big day, starting, you know, on Twitter with the video going viral of George Floyd's murder. And I think exposing something that, you know, obviously African-Americans experience all the time and has not appropriately visible to the rest of society, which is highlighting, I think, obviously a important and valuable use of Twitter.
Yeah, definitely.
Making the invisible visceral, not just visible, but making it visceral. And I say that to contrast it against this other moment where it's the first time Twitter rolled out, I guess, fact-checking the president, where they put this notice underneath saying it's about mail-in ballots. I don't remember the exact way that they phrased the kind of notice. And then Trump retorting that Twitter is trying to stifle free speech. This whole thing is so complex and so nuanced and so, you just see the kind of fractal nature of how this has all gone wrong. Gosh, I mean, let's talk about it. I mean, like what... It's important that Twitter is taking responsibility for, essentially, they've enabled exponential broadcast, right? So each of us are entitled to speech, but we're not entitled to reach millions and millions of people. And what they just handed out is football stadium sized audiences to each of us. You know, think of Oprah and you get a football stadium and you get a football stadium and you get a football stadium. And that was, by the way, just to link it back to the diagnosis of the attention economy. In an attention economy where we want your attention, each company, each technology company needs your attention, the cheapest way to get attention isn't to do these hijack your brain tricks like more notifications. The cheapest way is to get you to be an attention automaton, attention-seeking robot, to make you narcissistic, to want you to have as many followers as you possibly have, because now you'll come back every day and you'll post to lots of people. And that was the cheaper way to get attention than to not. And so giving everyone this sort of stadium-sized audience is part of this business model of advertising and keeping people's attention, just to name that as an important component.
The great German philosopher Marcus Gabriel, who we spoke to recently, said, the gurus of Silicon Valley have turned us into a digital proletariat at their service.
Yes, exactly.
And you know, it's so interesting because you say earlier that protecting a First Amendment right, but we all know that they're hiding behind the First Amendment for financial gain. That's the actual reality of the situation.
You mean because of Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act? Yeah. So just to make sure we're laying this out for I'm sure your audience probably knows this, but Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which was written in 1996, importantly, way before we had any of these kinds of issues, was meant to say if you have a bulletin board website in 1996 with animated GIFs and sites under construction signs, that you're not responsible if someone posts something, because they can post anything. It would kill the internet if you were responsible for every piece of content that was posted to a website. And so that was an important law. What they didn't anticipate was recommendation systems, that algorithms would be choosing to magnify and amplify things to billions of people. So let's be really clear about this. Twitter is not just this sort of neutral news feed that just says, what did your friends or, you know, what have your people that you follow posted? And we'll just show them to you in chronological order. They are obviously sorting based on what gets the most engagement, which means that they're taking a responsible position. They are responsible for what shows up at the top or bottom of a news feed. In the case, just to make sure we're matching it across all these other examples, YouTube, 70% of YouTube's traffic is based on what they're recommending to people. So people think, oh, YouTube, it's just a mirror of society. People are going on there, they're choosing what they watch, they're choosing the channels they subscribe to. This is not true. YouTube is recommending 70% of a billion hours a day of what people are watching is controlled by their algorithm.
Wow.
So the responsibility is on their side. And to link it to another big piece of news that came out yesterday was this Wall Street Journal bombshell piece about Facebook's responsibility for extremism and polarization. And specifically, a 2016 presentation internal to Facebook said that 64% of all the extremist groups that people joined on Facebook were due to Facebook recommending that into people's news feeds. So saying, these are groups you should join. These are groups you might want to discover. So in other words, they were actually responsible for that. So this is a critical point, because there's always this question of, is social media holding up a mirror to your existing society and you have those extremists and therefore we're not responsible? Or are we holding up a funhouse mirror that's distorting the surface area of what things you would see amplified in that mirror and what things you would see minimized? Mm-hmm. And what you see amplified are the extreme things that are whatever's good at getting attention, which means usually crazy town, extreme things, et cetera. And in each of these cases, YouTube, Facebook group recommendations, you know, you join one mom's group for sharing things for moms and it says, okay, what are other groups that moms tend to click on a lot and get really engaged by? Oh, I know, there's just these group called anti-vaccine groups. I'm an algorithm. I don't know what anti-vaccine is. I'm just going to start recommending that. Oh, and then you join that. It says, what are other groups that people who join anti-vaccine used to like? Oh, QAnon groups. And that's actually what happened in the Plendemic conspiracy video going viral. So all this is to say, to sort of bring us back, that the key is that these systems are not neutral and they've been hiding behind the fiction of neutrality because of Section 230 to say, we're not responsible for what your society looks like or what your society does. So taking us back to the whole free speech thing. It's such a complicated topic because it kind of goes in loops, because you have Twitter for the first time now taking responsibility for the extremely consequential speech. So when the president of the United States or when someone who reaches, you know, millions and millions of people says something about a highly consequential thing, like drink Clorox bleach or something, I actually don't think that they've released a fact-checking thing on that. But, you know, with mail-in ballots, they're choosing it. So I think one aspect to name here is they cannot do this for all kinds of facts because they've created a Frankenstein that generates misinformation at scales that it's like I Love Lucy in the chocolate line. You know, she's trying to like pick up the chocolate before it's going by, except imagine like trillions of pieces of content going by. And there's Jack Dorsey trying to like get his teams to do the fact checking thing. And you can't do that. You know, like we like to say, how many engineers at Facebook or Twitter or YouTube speak the 22 languages of India? Because if you think mail-in ballots misinformation is bad here, or, you know, drinking Clorox bleach is bad here, just think about the hundreds of countries that have no one doing the moderation and the fact-checking, et cetera, let alone the fact that it just doesn't scale. So what we've really created fundamentally is an asymmetry where technology is generating instances of possible harm that far exceed the capacity to remedy or even preempt that harm from happening. Because you generate 3 billion Truman shows and trillions of pieces of content, all ranked by algorithms that don't speak the languages of the people who are they're reaching and who don't know what's consequential, because it doesn't know based on a word classifier that hydroxychloroquine is consequential and apples and oranges are not. And that's kind of the fundamental problem. And I think it's important we frame the problems appropriately. And it's because of this exponential broadcast capacity that each person gets this stadium. And we just said at the beginning, the good side of that is that someone like George Floyd would have an audience for that happening in society. And the horrible side is that you have Alex Jones being recommended by YouTube 15 billion times. Again, not people clicking because they sought Alex Jones, but YouTube actively recommending Alex Jones 15 billion times. So you can go a lot of places with that. But.
Well, we've been talking about scale. I'm curious about speed and how you think about speed in the context of this as a factor in terms of how we got here. How do you think we can shift course going forward in a different direction? And how does speed kind of play into all of this?
Yeah, I'm really glad you're asking about speed because, you know, in the same way that our economy is energy blind, you know, it doesn't like think about how much energy goes into it or the finite resources of the planet. I think our technology systems are speed blind. They optimize for speed. They're controlling the kind of speed of society. They kind of have a dial for how fast it goes, but they're not thinking about it as a core ingredient for what makes a society operate. And I think if you just imagined in your, for any listener, you know, in your own life, what are the differences in your own life when you're operating, when you have 100 emails coming in, 100 Twitter messages that you're scanning through, 100 tabs that you can barely look at and you're getting overloaded by, versus something that's moving slowly? I think it's sort of self-evident. I think one aspect is when you look at, I've talked with Yuval Harari, the author of Sapiens, about this, that there's a temptation, given the things we just talked about, to want to say that truth is what we need to optimize for. Truth above all else. There are many load-bearing fictions in society that are actually important fictions. They can be stories that we've told that may not be true, but are important moral stories. They might be certain religious stories. There's a whole bunch of things that we repeat and tell ourselves and that may not be true, but they're ideals. They're metaphorically true. They're usefully true. And if you optimized for pure truth, you can imagine if you took the Sam Harris sort of argument, each religion is in conflict with a different set of claims than all the other religions. So according to a fake news killing algorithm, you would sort of take down all religious speech just unilaterally because they conflict with each other. So the reason I bring this up in the context of speed is it might be true that certain things aren't what they seem. But if you were to dismantle all of these important fictions in society really quickly, like imagine going into a kid's life and just killing Santa Claus and killing the Tooth Fairy and killing, like you kill all these things too quickly, it's not a humane thing to do. So there's this question of like moving at the speed of trust. And like I think a humane thing to do when it comes to technology design is operating at the speed of human relationship formation and trust formation. So how do Andrew and I know each other? We spent a couple hours in New York really going deep on, I think it was like 3 hours actually, going deep on some topics. And that's a relationship that's forming. That's trust that's forming. And I think technology takes away that process of trust formation. And so when you see someone who you don't like posting something in 250 characters where you don't see the context of what that person said, it's never been easier to hate someone out of context. And not have the trust for how to rebuild ground with them. And I think that's one of the aspects where speed is just killing us here. Because as important as, you know, George Floyd was yesterday, we're also moving on to the next thing tomorrow. And there's no time to be with anything anymore. And that's its own problem. I think about a tribal community back thousands of years ago at a Dunbar scale, 150 people in a community. If something went wrong or someone died or someone was unlawfully murdered, that would be with that community for a very long time. And now our collective consciousness moves on so quickly.
I wanted to bring up time in general to your relationship to time. I mean, before Center for Humane Technology, you founded the Time Well Spent movement. And this is connected in some ways to what we might even call slow tech, this idea of tech that's good, clean, fair, less outrage, more healthy conversations. Even connecting to Cal Newport's book from last year, Digital Minimalism. How do you think about time in relationship to technology right now?
Well, it's a famous saying that, you know, you can always make more money, but you can't make more time, and you have a finite amount. It's the ultimate equalizer in terms of no matter how rich you are or how poor you are, you have the same amount of time. And of course, on top of that substrate, you have inequalities of if you can't afford to live near a city, it takes 3 hours to go to work for a service working job, and you have to do that because that's what's required. But when I think about technology, you know, the Time Well Spent movement arose from my own existential search looking at existentialism, which is just a veiled way to say the obvious, which is what does it mean to have a life well lived? With your finite time on this planet, what is most important to you? And is your time flowing in the direction of things that are most important to you? For me personally, just to share where that came from, in this original TED Talk in 2013 or 14 that arose from that work and the time well spent movement that ensued, which resulted, by the way, in all the Apple and Google phones having these time tracking features and things like that, is just noticing the way our time is. I'll speak personally, my time was not flowing in where my values were. Mm. How can it be that I'm using technology that's supposed to be a bicycle for my mind to help us do the things that are most empowering for us and where our values are? And most of the time I spend with technology, it's not flowing to where I want it to go. You know, just the simple experience of email and rereading the email that I know is important, but I don't know exactly how to get back to that one. And then I reread it six more times. And I'm sure I should read Stephen Covey's Seven Habits or whatever for effective people. That inability to have our attention and time go to where our values are, to what's most important to us en masse. I think everyone feels that. And I think that's because time is the kind of denominator, the master denominator to all human experience and all of our choices. Like, you can make any choice, but choices are denominated by the time and energy that's consumed to enact them. We need technology that is about conserving not just time, but our conscious energy that goes into that process. I think a lot about climate change, and there are so many different timelines for different existential threats that we face, but we have very fixed timelines. So one way or the other, the kind of physics of do the rate equation, if there's this many years until the permafrost melts, show me the trajectory of choices, the kind of step-by-step between now and that finite time, that we're going to make the choices that add up. And if I can't even, as a human animal, like sit in front of my email and send the right emails and then do the thing that I want to do and pass the law that I want to pass with Congress around humane technology, how can anyone, given that they're also a human animal, overloaded by the same finite constraints of how the human mind works with technology, how are they going to focus on the right things? And so that's the thing I'm most worried about when I think about the attention economy is our time flowing to where our own deepest values and concerns really come from? And I think that's part of the project of time well spent in humane technology.
Mm. You mentioned climate change. In terms of the climate crisis, just climate action, how do you think Silicon Valley and big tech companies should be involved? I know on your most recent episode of your podcast, you mentioned this idea of the San Francisco Accords, sort of similar to the Paris Agreement. What are your hopes in terms of how technology can be harnessed or these big tech companies can be involved?
Well, this is a great question because it involves, I think, Andrew's opening question about what is the role of technology platforms in our society? Much like with coronavirus, like, why is it so important that technology platforms are not just kind of cesspools of misinformation that give us the wrong things, that make us act the wrong ways and kill ourselves with bad ingredients? These are the default and unavoidable information infrastructures that we now live on, right? Mm-hmm. So that means that they're default infrastructure, which means they have to operate in public, in the public interest. They can't be guided by whatever maximizes profit, whatever ads people want to show, even if it means misinformation ads about buying this cloth that won't protect you or buying this chemical solution that won't protect you. So the point there being, it's never been clearer that the digital infrastructure is the new 21st century infrastructure. So better or worse, Amazon has the sort of global lock on the supply chains and how we're going to get goods in a quarantine. Better or worse, Facebook is a default place where a lot of people are getting information. And that means that there's a public responsibility. And so when you think about that, and you think about the fact that this is the first time that technology platforms have stepped partially into a role, as Jack did with Twitter and the fact-checking the president, and as Facebook has done with prioritizing life-saving communication and the frames that say, stay home to save lives, you can add to your profile photo. They're taking these top-down conscious actions, saying we are going to actively steer society because it is a crisis. One way to justify why that's important is, you know, we had an emergency broadcasting system for the 20th century of television, right? Like, the TV goes blank and makes that sound. And like, we have that. We have laws for that. And when we move for the 20th century to the 21st century infrastructure, we lose all those protections. So Saturday morning cartoons, they're super protected and regulated what you can and can't show kids. That's 20th century. You move to the 21st century and we lose all those protections on YouTube. Now kids are just like thrown into the cesspool of YouTube. You know, election advertising, we used to have total lockdowns on fair pricing for Hillary and Trump have to run an ad on a Tuesday night in Kansas. It's got to cost the same amount of money for that ad to keep it a fair election. You go to Facebook and you lose all those protections in the 21st century. Emergency broadcasting system, same thing. So now if you ask the emergency broadcasting system for the 20th century, would say we have to prioritize what is true and of public interest for an emergency. And they've done that with coronavirus for the science-based information that we know about coronavirus. and they're starting to do that there. So now to loop all the way back to your question about climate change, we have the same science-backed threat that's also longer term. It is not political. Now, the exact mechanisms of how much carbon increases it versus methane versus ecological devastation and lack of forests and carbon sinks in the ocean, there's some questions there. But why couldn't technology companies take on a kind of chronic emergency broadcasting system for what we could do around acting there? So we had this podcast. We have a podcast called Your Undivided Attention that dovetails with all of our work at the Center for Humane Technology. And we interviewed Christiana Figueres, who negotiated the Paris Accords. That interview was interesting for two reasons. One is the psychology of she's the person who got 195 countries with different vested interests to agree when she herself also didn't believe that it would be possible to get them to agree. She admitted that to herself. And she talks about that in the interview.
She also talks about how it took a year, and she going into it, she kind of knew where she was at. So she also understood that before it happens, she had to realize what she was stepping into, which I thought was a great part of the interview.
Totally.
And you guys got her on board. So
yeah. Well, so that was the point. So we talked about in the interview, you know, the idea of a San Francisco Accords saying, you know, these technology platforms, when they talk about climate, it's always about greening their data centers, greening their operations. But what we're asking them to do is green their influence. They have an influence, a daily cultural influence on the world, whether they want to or not. And just like they have a daily influence on what people believe about coronavirus, whether they want to or not. And instead of taking their hand off the steering wheel and putting their hand over their eyes and letting the car drive itself while it drives off a cliff and sends people into misinformation and kills people, we're saying your hand is actually on the steering wheel, whether you want to admit it or not. And the coronavirus, they had to show that we have to steer it towards this life-saving communication. We're saying with climate, imagine a world where all of these technology companies like Earth Day 2021, or before that, hopefully, they flip into every single interface you see is about giving you an empowering way to relate to the climate crisis. So for example, Google and LinkedIn are kind of, when you do a search for any company name, they could show next to any official domain the carbon footprint of that company with a little globe icon or something like that right next to the URL before you click on it. So there's a notion of my reputation as a company in terms of this climate crisis is actually visible. And LinkedIn, for example, you know, that's where everybody goes to figure out where they're going to work. And imagine that every LinkedIn profile for every company showed essentially, oh, you're a fashion company, you're Allbirds. Well, for fashion companies, these are kind of the local drawdown for that category. You've got to do these kind of five categories of things. And we could just push that reputational, like this is how you're doing on those five things, directly into your LinkedIn profile. And by the way, if they're not doing enough, their own employees can see it. The people who might prospectively work there can see it. And by the way, because it's LinkedIn, to get them to do item number five on that list, we know because it's LinkedIn who the head of sustainability is. You can hit a button, it would do the automated search for the head of sustainability and send them an automated message.
Brilliant.
LinkedIn could by itself kind of almost like ransomware, like take the reputation of businesses hostage and say, we're going to give you your reputation back insofar as you are starting to take dramatic action. And again, it's the kind of game theory problem where you need all companies to act in unison. We, you know, the thing about why business is so important is that I think 71% of emissions are created from the top 100 companies. It's not this individual consumer behavior of whether I recycle or not, which is unrelated to climate. It's about the kind of business behavior. And so who controls the reputation of business? Well, Google.com with search results, LinkedIn, et cetera. You could have Google Maps. Whenever you're on Google Maps, it could show you prospectively where the wildfires are, and Zillow could show you, you know, anticipated flood risks, things like that. You could have 10-year to 50-year level sea level rise projected based on our choices about what we do, baked into the way we do Google Maps around the world. Some of these are more disempowering than others. I think it's important to say that, you know, and this is why we wanted to host like a San Francisco Accords, where you could get technology companies to buy in. And instead of 195 countries, you only have about, you know, 5 to 10 companies that you would just need to buy in to do this. And it's really about matching their existing commitments where their own operational decisions, like they're already putting their money where their mouth is when it comes to greening their data centers. They obviously believe in climate change. We just have to say, bring it into your influence on the world. And this country is ironically one of the only countries in the United States compared to the world where people actually doubt climate change so much. And that's in part because of social media polarizing us into echo chambers. One last thing on this, if you typed climate change is into Google, it would give you different results based on where you are. So if you're in the United States, the first autocomplete for climate change is a hoax. If you were in Denmark, it would say climate change is a wicked problem. If you're in China, it would say climate change is real. And that was based not on what was true, but what people happened to type the most, because Google is just, it's just an algorithm. It just says, well, what do people autocomplete the most after that thing? And that's also gameable. And so this is just to say that these software systems are steering the beliefs of 3 billion people daily. Why don't we use that to steer it in the public interest and public good? Now, that's going to bring up a ton of questions about who decides what's good. But that's the situation that we're in right now.
Yeah, and that's why you guys are set up. You're there to sort of steer this conversation forward and bring these ideas to the table. So obviously no one can predict the future, but do you have an instinct on what this is all going to look like 6 months from now? What's going to change?
You mean leading into the election, or you mean...
all of it. Yeah. Life in general. Yeah.
Well, I've got this crystal ball right here. Let me just...
Yeah, exactly.
ask it. Yeah. you know, it's hard. I am thinking a lot about how to anticipate some of the things that we're going to be seeing over the next 6 months. I mean, I think we're like the Wile E. Coyote, where we're way off the cliff and it just, we haven't looked down and realized, because of the amount of unemployment, second and possible third, fourth waves of the virus, that probably be in the third wave of the virus by the time September, October rolls around and going into the election. It's really, really hard. I mean, I think this is an unprecedented moment. I don't know what to say, except that what we want to encourage is a recognition of these facts. And I think that if you think about, compared to how slowly government can change, like even if you wanted to change, let's say, the financial system right now, this would be a great time to say, okay, the financial system, there's clearly a whole bunch of broken things. Guess what? Like, it was written in COBOL. So if you want to change it, you got to find all those COBOL programmers and try to figure out how you're going to do something different. So it's really hard to change things like government that slowly. It's really hard to change culture very quickly. But the technology companies are the fastest capable actors to change in the space. And that's why I think this idea of a San Francisco Accords, or them making some of these changes. I mean, how much time would it take? Probably like two engineers and a couple weeks to integrate the climate carbon disclosure project records into those Google search results. That would literally take like a day. Google already has a project called Project Sunroof that shows you how much it costs to implement solar panels built into Google Maps. How long would it take for them to integrate that into Google Maps? We already know the sea level rise projections. We already, like, on all these things, there's actually a lot that could be done by the technology companies. And to make it into a business argument, think about how inspiring it would be to go to work every day working for one of these companies saying, I'm going to help save my kids and the future generations. Yeah. And I'm the only actor who can actually do this. Like, no one else can do this. And so I think of it as like the biggest opportunity for hiring and retaining the best people in the world. So instead of Amazon just saying, we need 100,000 new essential workers to be in sort of a semi-slavery to do this thing, it's like, how do we actually have an inspiring vision for how we're going to make this humane and ethical and fair, and not just take the small low-hanging fruit and have that be the end of it?
Is anything recently giving a huge sense of hope that you're seeing?
Probably only as much as you're seeing. I think we're all living in these fragmented realities now. So, you know, even as you ask me that question, I'm saying, well, probably everything you're seeing. I have no idea what umwelt world you've been living in, because each of us with social media have a completely different bifurcated, fragmented set of facts that we're tuned into. We already know that our brains have a negativity bias, that our brains remember and recall and project onto the movie screen of our minds negative information more easily than positive information. Think about when someone gives you a negative compliment or negative comment versus a positive compliment, which one stays with you longer?
Yeah.
So to fix that inequality, you'd have to dose yourself, or this is what gratitude practices are about, overcorrecting in the kind of positive self-compliments, like you're, you know, being grateful for this and grateful for that and grateful for that. That's kind of equalizing your own internal newsfeed of your brain. Mm. And I think that when it comes to being optimistic about the world, it's never been easier to find really heartbreaking information right now and heartbreaking views about the future. We already know we have a negativity bias. So I will say that at least when it comes to changing the things in technology that we've been involved with, there were years where it felt like this would never change. I mean, back in 2013, we were saying so many of these things and it didn't change at all. And I will say that seeing Mark Zuckerberg say that time well spent is the new goal of Facebook in 2018, seeing Apple and Google roll out features to a billion phones that take the tiniest little baby steps in the right direction, is at least evidence that systems can change. And I think that's kind of what we need more of, is just going back to those times in history, whether it's Martin Luther King or Gandhi, or just these things that felt completely immovable were actually possible to change. And I think we need to point our attention there and try to be grateful for those moments in history and how we can tune into them now in the present.
I couldn't agree more. And, you know, you bring up Gandhi and it was really the salt tax, right? It's mm-hmm. it's the little things. Mm-hmm. And I think that, yeah, you're definitely taking that approach. We appreciate everything you're doing. We're cheering from the sidelines and watching everything. Thank you so much for your time today. We really loved having you on.
It's great to be here with you guys. Really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. To hear more episodes of At a Distance, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher. You can follow us on Instagram at slowdown.tv. To sign up for our weekly newsletter, Exploring the Five Senses, head to our website at www.slowdown.tv.